Ladies and gentlemen, we are here with another episode of Mixed Mental Arts, and we have the great Thaddeus Russell, who I've heard about a lot. Never listened to your podcast and never listened to you on Rogan, but I know you got glowing reviews. And then I picked up your book, A Renegade History of the United States. And as a history major, I have to say that this is a really, it's very original. It's a very original sort of take on history, and one that made all the sense in the world to me, because essentially you talk about, you know, so much of American history was shaped, the American character was shaped by our outcasts, our prostitutes, our drunks, our shifty quote-unquote slaves, the people that were always kind of that were kept on the outside looking mm-hmm. in, drunks. And I want to read just for a second. Let me just show you guys how he breaks his book into different sections. Part one, Making Renegades into Americans. Drunkards, laggards, prostitutes, pirates, and other heroes of the American Revolution. The freedom of slavery, the slavery of freedom, whores, and the origins of women's liberation. I love this. Part two, how white people lost their rhythm, a rhythmless nation. From white chimps to Yankee doodles, the Irish. The Jew was a Negro. Italian Americans out of Africa. Part three, fighting for bad freedom. Shopping, the real American Revolution. How gangsters made America a better place. Behold a dictator, fascism and the New Deal. And just how popular was World War II. Finally, with part four, which side are you on? How juvenile delinquents won the Cold War. Fucking amazing. A process of self-purification. The civil rights movement attack on African Americans. Gay liberation, American liberation, and then ready? Almost Free, the promise and tragedy of rednecks and hippies.
Jesus, hearing you say that, I'm offended by my own book now.
I love it, though. I love it, man.
How could I say those things?
Right. The New York you paint in the beginning of the book, you know, the New York of the 1700s mm-hmm. was a place I want to hang out. Well,
yes and no. These people shaped American culture. Mm-hmm. The argument in the book is that they shaped it largely for the better, mm-hmm. right? If they shaped it for the better, if you value personal freedom, so if you value like the weekend, if you value leisure, then the drunks have a lot to do with that because they were the ones who said the Puritan work ethic. This makes no sense to me.
Right.
We don't feel like working. You know, right. We're not going to work in the factory that you just created in the middle of nowhere. We're not going to work in this box all day long, according to this clock that you just invented to keep us there. And they just didn't work. And employers complained about it all the time. And what they had to do to keep these workers working was shorten the workday and then shorten the work week. And then unions and communists came along later and said, oh, we're going to take credit for this. We're going to make a movement around it because we know this is what the people want, the workers want. And so they get the credit for that in the sort of standard mainstream mm-hmm. history books now. But it came out of people just being drunk and shiftless. Really. Because if you think about it, right?
Or just being human. Well, the amount of drinking that went on, and I had read this stat before, was fascinating. Not to mention the amount of sex that went on. And you're so right. You talk about how sex is largely missing in historical narratives, unless it's hordes of Mongols raping and, you know, pillaging. But for the most part, it's done as it's portrayed as, you know, something that was done on women for men's sake only. And people were fucking mm-hmm. like they always do.
Yeah, I think I mentioned this in the book. I'm not sure. So, you know, I was in graduate school at Columbia University, high level graduate program in American history. So that meant I read, 500, 1,000 books on American history and probably another 500 or 1,000 scholarly articles on American history. And I'm not kidding you. This was in the early 90s, mid 90s. I don't think I read one thing about sex, about people actually having sex, what they thought about it, how they had sex, how many times they had sex, what kinds of sex. Now, that has changed since then, so I have to say there certainly are historians who do write about that now. Mm. But as of the 1990s, which is not that long ago, there really wasn't anything going on there. And then popular culture generally.
Why do you think that is?
Historians, well, at Columbia in particular, but that was true for all elite historians, and still, I think, mostly true among historians. it's a very conservative profession, meaning they're all liberals or socialists, but they're conservative culturally. And that's what turned me off to the whole thing, both history, professional history, and academia. They all claim to be progressives and liberals politically, and we could argue about whether even that's true, but certainly culturally, they're very, very uptight and repressed people. And
I've noticed with academics, especially on the left, that they tend to be sexless.
Sucks.
And they tend to be very, very, very conservative. They're humorless, too, to a large extent.
Totally. Yeah. It's I hated it. And so that was the beginning of my trajectory toward becoming the devil, basically, was that I saw that these people didn't care about, like, what clothes they wore. They never talked about sex. They never watched television. They didn't know who was in the movies. They'd never heard of a Madonna, literally. I mean, it was that bad for many of them. Really, I'm not even exaggerating.
I believe that. I know that.
Wait a minute. Are you saying the ivory tower is real?
Yeah. Yeah, but it's just the thing that's so galling to me is that, of course, these people hold themselves out to be and are presented as progressives, as the forward-thinking people, as the avant-garde, and they're just the opposite. Now, I'm not saying none of their work is worthwhile. I learned a whole lot about the Civil War and the causes of the Civil War, and I learned a whole lot about all the presidents, and I learned a whole lot about social movements like the Civil Rights Movement and the suffragist movement and all that stuff. But at a certain level.
Well, it's a macro perspective.
Yeah, so they, like, for instance, with the Civil Rights Movement, we were taught every demonstration, every leader of the movement, what they said. We read all their speeches. We had all these different theories about why the Civil Rights Movement emerged, when it did, and where it did. But no one actually looked at what Martin Luther King, for instance, said to black people about culture. Mm. So, because culture, again, is not of interest to these academic historians at all. So I just looked at it. I was like, hey, what did he actually say about black culture, which we hear about all the time now? And he just made these denunciations of black culture that, I'm not kidding you, if you can go read them, sound like the Ku Klux Klan. I mean,
who is this?
Martin Luther King Jr. He was saying black people are lazy. They don't work hard enough. They have sex too much. They drink too much, take drugs too much. They're infested with criminals. He sounded like the worst racist ever.
Wow.
And because the argument was, and it wasn't stupid, we have to present ourselves as perfect citizens in order to become citizens.
This is the fight.
Made into citizens.
Yeah, this is the fight.
We
have no margin for error.
Yeah, so assimilationism, right?
It's
pure assimilationism.
But I mean,
which is what a lot of cultures have done, right? If you look at the Asian cultures, when the Koreans came to this country or the Chinese, I mean, their kids were, you shut your mouth, get straight A's, mm-hmm. and then more straight A's, and also learn to play the violin and the piano fluently, and we'll throw tennis in there as well.
What's her name?
So they all get into...
Tiger Mom? Is that what that book? Yeah, right.
Yeah, there were no play dates.
Although that's true in Asia as well, so they're not assimilating into American culture necessarily, but the point, I think, for Asian Americans is that that culture, which happens to be common and native in most Asian countries, fits really well here, so that Americans love that, right? Come on over, and we'll let you in now. After 100 years of excluding them, right?
Yeah.
Now we realize, you guys work like dogs here, and you obey the laws, so everything's cool.
I'm always kind of drawn, sort of the American character is a biracial character. I mean, I can't imagine what American culture would be without black influence. So, from music to the way we dress, the way we speak, and there was so much color and flavor that came from whatever it is that Martin Luther King was criticizing in terms of whatever those cultures were.
Exactly.
A lot of it was just the fact that I think it was Stanley Crouch who said, look, man, when you were a musician and you had to come in the back room and play for all this white audiences, that was a heavy burden. And when you were doing well, there was all kinds of survivor guilt. So a lot of the drug use and the alcohol use was probably used because of how badly it did suck. There was a lot of good, but there was always how badly some of it sucked. Then you had these white musicians like Janis Joplin and Jim Morrison who were subscribing to that lifestyle. I'm going to give myself a drug problem because Charlie Parker had a drug problem and all that. That's the longer point I'm trying to make here. And I want you to talk about is the fact that it seems like these academics that have been telling us what American history is have been giving us this macro sort of idea. It goes back to what Hunter says, which is, you can look at big numbers and you can look at big movements, but it doesn't tell you anything about the people or what it was like to actually live there and be there?
I would say it's about what questions you ask, what you're interested in. So if you're interested in how to distribute healthcare equally, well, then yes, you shouldn't be worried about what jazz musicians were smoking in the 1920s. It's just that what I found was that what historians in particular and academics in general care about matches almost not at all what the vast majority of actual Americans care about and think about and how they live. Okay, now, that could be for better or worse. So I happen to know, because I would ask them this directly, that those people, academics, overwhelmingly look down their noses at what Americans actually choose to do every day with their lives. So for instance, ask an academic, any sociologist, anthropologist, historian, political scientist, what they think about the top 10 most popular TV shows right now. What do you think they're going to say?
They would probably say, amusing.
No, they don't even know what they are.
Oh, they don't know what they are.
Oh, but it's appalling to them. No. They're very, very disappointed in you, in mm-hmm. us, in Americans. And I've asked them this directly. And I asked a very, very prominent, she was actually one of the sort of the deans of American women's history, kind of the founders of that genre of American history. I said, so, you know, the evidence shows that, like, at the turn of the 20th century, with commercialism rising and department stores emerging, that American women were really interested in shopping and going to the movies and going to Coney Island. And she said, yeah, I know. Why? I said, why do you not write about that? When you write these huge histories of American women, that's hardly mentioned in your book. She says, because I think they had better things to do.
God damn. It is fascinating to me. You know, every time I read, if you read Immanuel Kant or Hegel or Nietzsche or any of these people, whether it's even Socrates, the thing that sort of Kierkegaard, most of these guys were, and you read their philosophy, and they sat around thinking, and you're like, okay, and a lot of times it was a rebuttal to the philosophy that came before them. And a lot of times you're like, but wait a minute, hold on, dude. How did you live? Oh, you lived with your mom, and you were alone, and you never got laid, and you were kind of sickly as well. And, you know, you kind of go, it's very difficult for me to listen. You're a very smart guy, and you're breaking life down. But you, my friend, haven't lived. Come hang with me sometime when I was younger.
The problem is twofold. I think the cause of this mentality among academics, and again, you know, That's one way of looking at the world. I'm not saying it's evil or necessarily wrong. It's just one very particular way of looking at the world. And you can organize your life. You can organize your society around it. I don't want to, but that's your choice. But why do they think this way? Overwhelmingly, I think it's two reasons. One is that they're intellectuals, so they live in their minds. You know, mm-hmm. I'm kind of one of them. I get this. You know, we live in our minds. We experience the world through, you know, thoughts, ideas, internal stuff. We are not very connected with our bodies, you know, which is one of the reasons when I started doing martial arts, in fact, that it was like the most exciting, hugest turn on in my life, because it was like, oh my God, I have this other thing below
what
my
are
neck.
You training?
Below my neck, Muay Thai and boxing.
Awesome.
And when I tell, and I'm a huge MMA fan, and when I tell, what do you think when I tell my, I don't tell them. I don't tell them that I do this, that I watched the UFC. I mean, that's the most appalling, abysmal thing.
That's right.
In the world.
And this is, I just want to say, like, this is, there's a great Emerson quote about how, you know, that when you hear genius, it's your own thoughts reflected with a certain alienated majesty.
Yeah, I love that. That
is what it is like listening to you, because the experience that you have had in the humanities is exactly the same experience that I had in science. On my first day at Cold Spring Harbor, I asked my boss, what are we studying? And he said, we're studying the bovine papillomavirus. And I was like, what's that? Like, why are we studying that? And he says, oh, it's the cow wart virus. And I'm like, I still don't get this. And he said, oh, it's related to HPV, which is related to certain kinds of cancer, so blah, 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 blah. And I said, oh, okay. So at some point, this might be used to, like, help people and maybe prevent cancer or something like that. And he goes, oh no, but that's what we tell the people so they'll give us money.
Yeah.
And that was literally.
So what's driving him? Why does he
contempt.
Do this?
Contempt. There's in science.
No, but why bother doing the research?
Oh, because it's his fun, like, theoretical, let's gather some bizarre. Yeah, it's some sort of, and there's, like, real contempt for practicality in the science, because the highest thing, the purest thing, is theory. And whoever can do the thing that is the most theoretical, that's why in the sciences there's like math is the purest, and then physics is dirty math,
and chemistry
is dirty physics, yep. and then biology is dirty chemistry. Yeah. And so that's right. why, and even, I mean, this drives economics, because the whole thing about economics was it was the dismal science. It didn't have any respect. And so what they tried to do, they took Adam Smith and they tried to turn it into math. And, you know, they tried to remake it into this, like, great high-level, you know, mathematical thing. And it doesn't belong there.
I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, right? Because, I mean, there are a lot of scientists who do great stuff. They make things that I like to play with and, you know, like to drive in and fly around in. So go for it. So I actually have very little beef with the sciences.
Oh, but you should.
I probably should. I don't know what they do, except that they kind of, everyone's going to produce things that I like.
I think what you're saying, and it's the same thing you say in your book, is that it doesn't mean that these people like this dean of history or the scientists don't have value. They provide value, and many times they create an orderly society. You wouldn't want to live in a society run by the people you talk about in your book as having made the American culture and character better. But, you know, you need both. You need both.
But it's also worth recognizing what is the price of the ivory tower and what is the price of contempt. And the price is that they have theoretically figured out a lot of things, a lot of great things that then never move out into the public knowledge and that are never applied. They're all just piled up in there. Yeah. And
or you're not able to apply them sometimes, you know, like there's this whole cultural Marxist movement, this idea of sort of, you know, it's the patriarchy and there are oppressors and oppressed. Most of us are too busy to even deal with it. Like, you can pass all the sexual, every time I do a TV show or something, we have a sexual harassment seminar and you have to sign the stuff. It's hilarious. So you're going to teach me how to behave with women. And, you know, okay, I get it. All right. And we all sit there like this, including the women, men and women. We all sit there and we're doodling. We're like, yeah, okay, cool. Is that, we done? Nice. And then we go about our day. And again, it's like you're trying to legislate good behavior and you're trying to legislate, you know, sort of thought patterns and stuff. Yeah. Good luck to you.
Yeah, they do the same thing with us, too. In universities, we have to take, there's a mandatory sexual harassment awareness thing you have to take online. And I just refuse to do it. I won't do it.
You should. Because I mean, how did the women's movement do in getting rid of very high heels?
Well, no. It's excuse me. How do you know how I should conduct my life better than I do?
That's right. That's right.
How do you know that I have a problem, that there is a problem with how I relate to other people, including
women?
This is
what bias training is about, you know?
So this is the other big problem with intellectuals and academics, is that they are self-appointed masters. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They are the experts. And this whole thing with Trump, the Trump era, signaling or representing the end of expertise as a bad, right? This is the crisis. In fact, there was a book written with that title, I think, The End of Expertise. And this was seen as a huge crisis. And I said, my God, what a cause for celebration.
I agree.
Let's have a party.
Really, I love this perspective because I do worry sometimes that there's such an, I mean, Trump is so fiercely anti-intellectual. He only goes by his instincts.
Yeah.
That's a big liability.
So this is a weird thing to say because I'm, I'm an intellectual. I'm a professional intellectual. I've always been. I'm in the right now. I'm wrestling with this. I'm becoming sort of anti-intellectual. So let's think about this. In particular, experts, right? Let's think about the history of experts and what they've actually produced and what they've done. Think about it. Okay. Yeah. So, racism invented by professors in the 19th century, starting with Thomas Jefferson. Scientific racism. This thing that there are Negroes and Mongoloids and all these races of the world, and there's a hierarchy among them, and some are more intelligent than others, and some are better suited to menial labor than others. And if you study the skull shape and the size of their nose and the color of their skin, you can determine who should be a slave and who shouldn't. Okay. Mm-hmm. That did not come from rednecks in Alabama. That came from the super elite intellectuals of the United States of America from the founding all the way through the 19th century. So that by the turn of the 20th century, if you were to walk into a Harvard or a Yale seminar on social science, they would spend days teaching you the taxonomy of the races of the world.
Wow.
And you would learn that you, because you were white, because you were at Harvard, you were a Nordic person. You were of the Nordic race of Northern Europe, best white people, the smartest people in the world, the founders of civilization.
Taller. Blue eyes.
They should have the vote. They should be president. They should have unlimited immigration into the United States. then there's the Mediterraneans who are the Southern Europe and Eastern Europe.
Hard workers, but a bent people.
But dumb as shit. Dumb as shit.
Prone to violence. They carry daggers.
Exactly.
Pickpockets, natural pickpockets.
A
bent people.
Over-sexualized.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
Don't leave your wife unattended around them.
Never, never.
And but these are all Europeans.
This are you talking about me? Oh, you're talking about, all right, yeah.
You're talking about, this was Italians, Greeks, right? Yeah. And then there were the Alpines, were in Central Europe. Dumb, not quite as dumb, good farmers. Don't want to give them necessarily the vote. They certainly shouldn't be the leader of an organization.
Were these real conversations in
Brian, these were books. There are stacks of books written also, by heart. I'm telling you, the elite intellectuals of this country were not just sort of tossing this off as a theory. They were developing it.
I know they studied criminals' faces and brains.
Phrenology,
if you could see something in their
and
face.
And the other thing, here's the thing that also never gets talked about. The Scopes monkey trial was actually about eugenics.
Outstanding point, yes.
Yes. So we get told this narrative of the Scopes monkey trial where it was like, oh, you know, these backward religious people, you know, they opposed to the teaching of evolution, blah, 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 blah. But actually, the real thing that William Jennings Bryan objected to was the fact that this book was using evolution to teach eugenics to justify all the horrible things of eugenics. And as a Christian...
Can you explain to people what you mean by eugenics in that context?
So eugenics is...
You should know something about it. Yeah. I worked at Cold Spring Harbor, which was the leading laboratory in eugenics.
So Cold Spring Harbor, where I was the year before college with Jim Watson and all of that sort of stuff, Cold Spring Harbor was, as you say, the mecca of eugenics. And eugenics, EU in Greek, just means good, and gen, genes, right? So there are people with good genes and there are people with bad genes. It takes the basic idea of animal husbandry or cow breeding or horse or dog breeding and applies it to humans. It says, we look at all these different social behaviors, there's criminality, there's hard work, there's intelligence, there's stupidity, and clearly all of this stuff must be caused by genes, which is not a totally crazy assumption. But what therefore they decide is that we're going to treat humans the way we treat cows. We're going to sterilize the ones that are bad, and we're going to overbreed the ones that are good to produce a superior human.
Right.
So they start to engage in things like forced sterilization of people who are undesirables.
Well,
because
you have what you're talking about is an entirely quote unquote rationalistic society. You're
exactly.
Your God is God of rationality, which has always been my beef with Sam Harris.
There you go.
Because Christianity came along, and the contribution, in my opinion, the great contribution, this is coming from somebody who doesn't go to church or really not a Christian in any, but I think that the biggest contribution that Christianity has offered us is that everyone is of the same moral worth. That's what our justice system is predicated on. I mean, if I kill a wretch in the street or I kill Bill Gates, technically I do the same amount of time. At least we have the same moral outrage about it. You could see very easily, you know, make the case that you've got a lot of vegetables in hospitals and a lot of people that are very badly deformed. We need those resources for our gifted children here in Santa Monica, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right?
But it becomes what it really is. This is not about rationalism, right? This is about atomism. It's about this very narrow-minded worldview, and it's about not looking at context. So that you look at, so it depends on what we mean by rationalism. Okay, so I think that's the thing, is that there's rationalism as this sort of the way that, I mean, thank God we're talking about Sam Harris, but, you know, when Sam talks about, Sam Harris confuses his cultural biases for being objective. Like, Sam Harris is very atomistic. Exactly. He's the poster child for this very, like, I look at the tree and I think that I'm seeing the whole forest or I'm seeing the world as it is. He is being driven by emotions of which he is not aware, and he thinks that that is reality. He's the poster child for naive realism.
Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. That's exactly what I would say about it. Well, I have many things to say about Sam Harris, but that is one of the most important things that's missed about who he is and how he thinks. If you listen to him, I don't want to become too obsessed with the guy, but I think he actually is really important because he's maybe the leading public intellectual right now in this country. Mm-hmm. If you look at, you know, how many people listen to him.
I love the people that he has on a lot of times. And
I mean, I'm fascinated by the conversations. I also think he's, and I hate to say this, but I'm going to say it anyway. I think he might be the most dangerous person in this country because I think that he is winning over a lot of people, mostly liberals actually, to a way of thinking that I actually think directly leads to war And things like, I'm not saying he's directly advocating eugenics, but he gets so close. Listen to the episode he had on his podcast just a few months ago with the author of the book Gene, mm-hmm. in which Harris goes right up to saying, well, what if there's a pill the government would force women to take if it, you know, would reduce birth defects? I mean, shouldn't the government do that? And the guy had to talk him down from that.
Yeah.
That is straight eugenics. That is straight up eugenics.
Yeah, I think to be somewhat fair to Sam,
sterilization.
I think Sam's searching too. I mean, I think that you can change his mind. He has a natural sort of impulse to
argue. Can you change his mind?
I have listened to a lot of his podcasts, and I think that he's a guy who, I think he's always been searching. I mean,
how hard is he searching? Because I think that's the question: is how hard is he searching within him?
So, unpack more about why you think he's so dangerous.
So he has a very famous TED Talk about 5 years ago, which I think sort of put him on the map for a whole lot of people. In which it's in the title of the talk. It's an argument for an objective ethics, an objective morality. And he says we need to find as if there's something you could discover, right? An objective universal set of values and make sure everyone holds these values. That's the problem in the world, according to him, is that there's disagreement about what is good and what is bad.
Well, his values, though, are very mathematical. They seem very rational.
Exactly. And then he says in that talk, and he's said this many times before, scientists and science can tell us what the correct good values are.
Oof, like the Soviets?
That's his whole theme.
Like
Am I right,
Soviet
Hunter?
Union?
That's his whole theme.
And also, here's the most amazing thing. Sam Harris doesn't understand what science is. That's what the whole conversation with Jordan Peterson about truth really reveals, which is that he actually doesn't understand what science is at all.
Wait, Hunter, hold on. He looked at a whole lot of scans of the brain. He knows what goes on.
Okay.
This is also the amazing, the brain scan thing. His whole career is founded on this, that he looked at a bunch of brain scans when he was writing his dissertation and from that concluded X, Y, and Z about human behavior. That whole thing, you know more about this than I do, but as I understand it, scientists since then have debunked most or all of that whole field of science, of using brain scans to make claims.
Well, they had the dead salmon.
Well, so there's a famous study about this dead salmon, where they put a dead salmon in MRI, and then they drew a whole bunch of conclusions from the MRI of the dead salmon. Also, by the way, William M. Briggs, who is a statistician, did a 7-part thing on Sam Harris's PhD of an example of scientism. He's like, it's amazing the number of things that he simultaneously gets wrong in this. So
First of all, neuroscience, when you're a neuroscientist, it's a very wishy-washy term. Talk about a dirty science. I mean, it's not as though Sam Harris is an expert on the brain and its chemical. It's not.
He claims to be.
He's not a neuro.
He's a PhD. Am I right? In neuroscience
from UCLA.
But you get that from there. There are. It is actually probably in many ways more of a social science. You're logging how people react cognitively, emotionally to certain stimuli, et cetera, et cetera.
But
so it's difficult to make hard, measurable.
I think that's what Hunter is saying.
But see, here's the real problem, right? So the question is, you know, Sam likes to talk a lot about intellectual honesty. And I did a podcast, I did a series of, after the Peterson thing, I did a series of 3 podcasts with Spiros Michalakis, who is a quantum physicist at the Institute of Quantum Information and Matter. And Spiros said the most important thing that any scientist can understand, which is that you can't have intellectual honesty without emotional honesty, because you are always being driven by your feelings, and that is always affecting your thinking. And the problem is that Sam presents this view of objectivity, and science is about the awareness that no human is individually objective. And John Haidt, at the beginning of the Haidt-Harris podcast, says, the big difference between you and I, Sam, is that you are a rationalist and I am an intuitionist. Mm. And I have very little faith in my own ability to reason individually, but I have great faith in the collective project of science where we are all testing each other's
thinking.
Well,
you know, Paul, the apostle Paul would actually agree with you. Christianity, I think in his letter to the Corinthians, I mean, he said, don't trust your own judgment. Your own heart is very deceptive, which is why ultimately you need this truth, or at least don't think as a human being, because you're learned, that you have the answers.
Yep.
Right? So Michael Malice was talking about how the Soviet Union was run by scientists and engineers. But when you have people like that, they will make very rational decisions for you, which can be things like your child is spazzing out.
But they're not making. I see, and this is where we get into the definition of the word rational.
Yeah.
Because what they're making is they're making rationalizing decisions. Yes. They are rationalizing the prejudices and the beliefs of their own culture and confusing their naive realism about that with reality.
Pinochet was a very rational man, I'm sure, because Pinochet said, "I'm fighting an insurgency.
Absolutely.
I've got to make it so painful for anybody who's a socialist or a communist. I'm going to have them raped by dogs. I'm going to have them tortured. Blah blah blah." And I'm going to wipe them out. And so I may kill, I may disappear 6,000, 10,000, 100,000 people today for the betterment of my 20 million countrymen 20 years ago. You can 20 years later, you can make very strong arguments for that. But of course, but the crux is we don't do that. There is something called cruel and unusual punishment. There is something called the Geneva Conventions. Why? Why is it that we have limitations on how we get to an objective? Why is that?
So if you want to go there, I'd love to.
Yes.
This is not exactly a tangent, but sort of a different subject. Why do we have limitations on punishment, in particular in war? Well, as a historian, and this is one case where I agree with a lot of historians, it's a way for the United States to exert its hegemony over the world, right? Because we have such a huge military, such a powerful economic base, we will dominate. And so rules like that are just work in our favor because we're going to run the place anyway.
That's cynical, though, isn't it? That is.
So if we, the thing is a little cynical. On my part, I admit it. So if we can do this physically, the way Pinochet did, right? We can just exert, our force, power over everyone through our tanks and our planes. But what we really need, of course, is for people to believe in us morally, that we're doing it for their own good. Then they will invite us into their countries. Mm. Then they will cheer when we invade, right? They will cheer when we give their dictator a bunch of money, whatever it is. So that's why all this stuff, and it all came out of World War II, by the way, that's why the United States established the United Nations and all the rules of the United Nations and new Geneva Conventions and all the rules of warfare, putting the United States forward as this moral exemplar, meaning the people who should run the world, who are the good people, so let us do it. This was all, by the way, this is not a conspiracy. This was all up front.
And this is what this
I would
is what
agree with that,
publicly
but I
stated.
I think that you have to also, a key factor also is the fact that there are a lot of Americans, myself included, who also believe in the right way and the wrong way, the moral way and the immoral way, the ethical way and the unethical way of doing things.
Just as there are a lot of Muslims and Christians and Soviets
this gets to the heart of it. Okay, yeah. This gets to the heart of it. This is what I was talking about with Sam Harris, right? His whole thing is there is such a thing as an objective ethics. There is an objective good and an objective bad. We can, through science, through the scientific method, we can find what is a good morality. What is good and what is bad? Do you believe in that? Do you believe in an objective, meaning a universal, absolute, and eternal good or evil?
Well, now you're talking about Christianity. You're talking about the Greek Socrates, which we talked about. And I think that's, I would never... what you're asking me to be is God right now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And guess, do you believe you're God?
I guess what the new atheists...
When I take my shirt off,
guess what the new atheists
God.
Have become? New gods.
God.
This is what's so ironic about them.
And it's amazing because...
They claim to... Not only do they claim that there is such a thing as an absolute, universal, eternal truth or morality, they also claim to be the ones who know how to find it.
Well, Sam is a little bit... Sam will grant...
They are the most religious thinkers.
Yes.
No, really. They are the most religious thinkers in this society.
This is what Hunter says, so I'm fascinated.
Right now.
This is literally...
They are priests.
This is exactly... Your
they are priests and popes, and they are the most religious thinkers.
Because here's what I find amazing.
Amazingly ironic.
Here's what I find amazing, right? So we all look at hunter-gatherers, and we're like... Hunter-gatherers had myths, they had beliefs, they had, all sorts of cults that they created and all that sort of stuff. And then we see, when you look at the New Atheists, they're like, okay, and then that continues to Christianity. Clearly, that's a mythic society, right? Islam is a mythic society. But then, and I believed in this, I grew up in this cult, we believe that there was this great break somehow with the Enlightenment, you know, the Enlightenment, we moved into an age of light. And lo, before was the age of ignorance, the age of darkness. And the land was filled with plagues and pestilence and famine. But we, the great bringers of truth, changed all of that. This is the oldest
myth. That is partially true.
That is the oldest myth that every religion tells about itself. And that is the myth of the West. And the West has told itself this fantastic myth. And Brian,
But Hunter, I can point to all the things I benefit from: anesthesia, vaccines, antibiotics.
Excellent point.
I mean, being able to fly places. Stacks of fruits and vegetables in the wintertime. Come on.
Yep. Excellent. That's the great point. Myths don't work.
And democracy.
Well, hang on,
myths don't work if there isn't a grain of truth to them, or if there isn't even a lot of truth to them.
Wait. Hold on. So, but you consider those things to be good, planes and aesthetics, right? Because of the culture you live in, the particular frame with which you view the world.
Well, it extends my biology. I don't have to see my children die in front of me.
But it's possible, isn't it, to see those things as bad, to see things like death as good, even death of children.
I disagree with you. Smallpox, when my children, three of my children die of smallpox, or for that matter, when I watch three of my kids die of a fever the way Lincoln did.
No. So historically, it's just true that many people disagreed with you, that there are just many, many examples historically of people thinking all kinds of things about death and about the death of children and about what we should do with children children.
You deal with the hand that's given to you, but the idea that, you know, we are not at least physically and emotionally more comfortable.
No, I'm just saying that you think it's immoral, right, to kill a child, I suppose, right, is what we're saying here. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying to you is that historically and in other parts of the world right now, there are many other people who totally disagree with you, who think it's either not immoral or actually a moral good to kill children.
So then this...
Really? Okay, so to say that... So you can absolutely say that's how I prefer to live and that's the society I want to live in. Mm. Great, no problem there. I have no problem with that. That's not an eternal truth claim, right? That's just a preference, a value, right? And you can even try to structure the society you live in according to your own values. I have no problem with that either. You'll come into conflict with other people, but that's fine too. And we'll work it out one way or the other. Hopefully you'll find a lot of people to live with or around who agree with you, have the same values. The thing that my whole beef with academia, just the world, actually, Harris is just one small part of this. This is most of my culture, American culture, is the truth claims. And again, when I say truth claim, I mean claims that some things are eternal, absolute, and universal. They were always true in the past. They will always be true in the future. They are true everywhere in the world for all people. That's a problem. That's a real problem. Truth claims to me, I think Hunter said this before we started recording. What did you say? The most damaging,
truth is the most destructive idea in human history. Yeah. And that's the point of the irony.
What do you replace it with?
Well, that's.
I just told you how to replace it. Mm. We replace it all the time. We don't walk around usually, right, saying, I'm going to have a cup of coffee because it's morally good. I'm going to get married because it's morally good. I'm going to drive my car because it's morally good.
So individual liberty is really what you're after in terms of letting people make their own decisions and their own mistakes.
You can even argue for something like universal health care without making a universal truth claim. You can say, as I said to you just now, I want to live in a society in which everyone has health care. That's not a universal truth claim.
But the crucial thing,
what about
Brian,
objective law? What about objective
law
versus subjective
law? That's a real problem.
How would I structure a society and how would I deal with conflict resolution? There are realities on the ground.
We make collective decisions. That's how societies actually operate.
That's how hunter-gatherers operate. And, you know, for that example, right, in his book, Jared Diamond, The World Until Yesterday, he talks about how do hunter-gatherers actually deal with crime, right, in inverted commas. And, you know, he tells the story of this guy who's driving along and he's a delivery driver and he accidentally hits this kid and kills the kid. And then what they focus on is truth and reconciliation. They get the families together and they basically say, what do we need to do in order to make you whole? And then they're making sure that everyone is dealt with.
Okay, but you're talking about justice. So if we talk about that, that's a great example, because you are dealing in many ways, for all intents and purposes, with fixed truths. So justice. Mm-hmm. Justice is something I think all of us recognize, at least in its... In that, you know, things have to be put back in their place when they are taken out of their place. Okay. So I kill your child. I have to pay a price for that. I take your livelihood. I got to pay a price for that. At least all of us yearn and have nostalgia to, in some way, unless we have the value systems of, for example, the Mongols. We also know that when you adapt, when you, history has taught us that when you sort of, adopt those sort of might makes right, strictly might makes right principles like the Mongols, unfortunately your society is no longer very stable because you become a snake eating its own tail. So now we have sort of corrupt systems of belief, or at least systems of belief that seem to not work and lead to stability or productivity or most importantly maybe the development of human potential. And then we have societies, in my opinion, like the Founding Fathers came up with, the Federalist Papers and the Constitution, that approximate as close as you can get to at least celebrating what human beings can become or should become.
Do you think that we can do better than the Founding Fathers, or did we?
I wouldn't try.
Why not?
I'd be very careful about trying. I think the Constitution is pretty, pretty amazing as far as one of the great ideas of philosophy. Something went right in those 3 months.
Nobody's saying that that's not the best yet that's been done, but Microsoft.
You're saying keep things open. You guys are both saying, I think
Windows 95 was great, but I don't think it's the be all and end all.
When you adhere to orthodoxy, when you adhere to fundamentalism, when you adhere to fixed truths, i.e., Plato, i.e., Christianity. Yes, I think that what happens is you blind yourself to other possibilities. You blind yourself to progress, maybe. You blind yourself to real inclusion.
Not only do you blind yourself, you stop the conversation from happening. You stop research from being done. You stop people asking questions about those things, right? This is the whole problem with truth claims. You're saying that is settled. We can't talk about this anymore. We should not talk about this anymore.
Brian, just to point out, in terms of the justice system, the genius of English common law is that it isn't as black and white as the Napoleonic Code. Mm-hmm. The judge in the Napoleonic Code just sits there and is like, this is what the rule says. I'm going to apply the rule.
There's natural law and then there's the...
In the English common law, it's up to interpretation.
Right.
And there's the opportunity to look at what applies in this case? How are we going to use the different precedents? The problem is that even within the justice system, you remember we had Adam Benferrato on talking about unfair, and there are hard and fast rules. And you find out that those hard and fast rules often create problems, or that people think they're being objective when they're really not being objective.
This is where circumstantial evidence comes in. This is where, this goes back to your book. I think that there is, when you study history, you can study these giant trends and this sort of change over time and what happened and these movements. But then, what you're leaving out is the place where the humans actually lived. What did it smell like? What did it look like? What did it feel and hear sound like? There's a historian who said, I want you to think about what it sounds like when a civilization falls. And he was describing what the Turkish cannons were doing to the walls of Constantinople, as they knew after 1,000 years those walls were going to fall and they're going to be sold into slavery. Those are very important, visceral truths that you need to keep in your mind.
Stop using that word, man.
Visceral?
We've gone over this.
Truth. Sorry.
Because that's the problem of, you talked about...
Oh, I said truths. There are plural truths.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
You get a pass.
Which is what Nietzsche talked about. There are plural truths.
But I mean, you talked about...
Infinite truths.
You talked about August. I would agree. Infinite truths. And that's what science is about.
Science is about that?
Yes.
Is mathematics about that?
Yes.
Absolutely. Yes.
It's about, this conversation that I had with Spiros, the analogy he used is he said, imagine that you have a television and you're standing with your nose up against the television. Well, you're going to see a certain pattern. You're going to see all these crazy dots and you'll be able to see whatever. And he's like, that's quantum physics. And there's a certain set of rules and approximations and stories that you use to approximate that reality. Then you back out a little bit. Now you start to see these big colored blobs. And now you're at the chemical level. And now you're going to see a whole different set of approximations and stories. When we talk about, for example, the idea that there's a nucleus and, it has protons and neutrons and it functions like, planets orbiting the sun and there are these electrons, that's a story. It's a story about how matter works, but it's not the reality of how matter works. And then what happens is that you get people like Werner Heisenberg, who's like, there's real problems with that story. A better way to think about this is as these sort of discrete quantum levels.
Yeah.
And then there's a different set of stories that operate when you're at the molecular level, and a different set that operate at the level of the ecosystem, and on and on and on.
This is true. One of my favorite things to watch, like when Einstein came along, this patent clerk, and he said, by the way, Newtonian reality, yeah, that works here, but there's another reality. And oh, by the way, space and time are relative, and space is curved. What the fuck? This Jew, it was Jewish science. Sure. Get this Jewish science. This guy's not even a scientist. And he was largely either ignored or considered a kook until, he was like, oh, and by the way, light bends
because
to gravity. What?
He was challenging the religion of the day.
Yes, he was.
And the religion of the day was Newtonian mechanics.
The religion that we live in, the religion that makes sense to us from our perspective.
And by the way, speaking of Einstein, guess what astrophysicists discovered just a couple years ago, that his theory needs revising because they found something way outer space that was moving not according to his theory of relativity.
You mean the orbit? Mercury was always a problem.
Something way out, I don't know what it was, but I know that they are currently revising Einstein's theory, right? They always are. So if a scientist ever says, I have discovered the truth, or even a truth, what are they saying? They're saying stop doing research.
Well, Einstein was also trying to come up with a unification theory,
But Spiros said the whole point is he says the whole idea of the theory of everything is a great marketing gimmick. It's amazing. There's like one answer out there, and we're going to find it. And once we find that one answer, all our problems will be solved. We'll be able to time travel. We'll be able to do all this sort of stuff. And he says we should talk about theories of everything because it's a series of models that approximate different levels of reality. And we still use Newtonian mechanics. We didn't stop using Newtonian mechanics because Einsteinian mechanics is useful near the speed of light. For most of us in our everyday life, we just use Newtonian mechanics.
Yeah. Again, though, I mean, so what I'm suggesting is that we evaluate all these different stories, all these different theories, according to our values, that we begin with what do I want? What do you want?
What do you want?
What kind of a world do you live in? So
yeah, but how do I anchor my values?
Right. So I like to live in a world in which the government won't arrest me and put me in prison for criticizing the government.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I prefer.
You want to say in who governs?
So I prefer the Bill of Rights over other constitutions, mm-hmm. In the world. But I don't claim that is right or good for anyone else. Anyone else. What I want to do, though, is live with people who agree with me on that, right? With as many of them. I'm never claiming what you should think or should want. Your values are autonomous to me. I don't want to make any claims for what
you should
want.
So you would not have invaded Iraq.
Right. I mean, so I'm as anti-war as anybody, but I never made actual moral arguments about it. I never said this is morally bad. I think it's stupid, and it's imperialistic in its own way. Right?
And because it shows a total lack of self-awareness.
You're making claims on behalf of other people, and you're making claims usually on behalf of people you will never meet, you know nothing about, except that they exist somewhere in the world, right? That is imperialism. That's putting my mind in your head. In the heads
I remember
of other people.
When George Bush, George W. wrote when they told him that the missiles had launched in 2003 and we had begun shock and awe with Iraq. He said he wrote, "Let freedom reign," and it was his Texas, idea of how everybody should live.
I mean, for one thing, there were lots of Iraqis who did welcome the invasion.
Yep.
And there were lots of Iraqis who did not welcome it. So first of all, just empirically, you can't make a claim on either side, right? That it's good for them. They have their own ideas about what's good for them. And I don't think I want to be in the business of making claims for them on that. The reason I opposed the Iraq war was that I thought it would affect me negatively down the line. I'd have to be paying higher taxes to pay for the tanks. And we're probably going to piss off a lot of people and make enough people in that world think Americans are evil that they might actually get into airplanes and come and fly them into our buildings, and I might be in one of those buildings.
Mm.
Purely self-interested, purely utilitarian. So I view the Constitution of the United States that way. I don't think it's the best thing for anyone else. I just happen to like a lot of what's in there. I happen to like living in a country in which the cops can't, well, they can sort of now, but barge into my house and arrest me for any reason at all.
I think I don't think there's anybody on the planet, though, who doesn't want some say in who governs them.
That's amazing.
The idea that people
that
like to live under monarchy.
That's amazing you would say that.
But who would in their right mind want to be a slave, essentially? What you're saying is that there's some people that prefer slavery.
The answer is about 99% of people who have lived on Earth.
Yeah.
They didn't have a choice.
No, they
sure,
did.
Sure they have.
Hobbes.
All kinds of choices.
So the point is that Americans, this is
but
the
wait,
thing.
So you guys are saying that people prefer slavery over democracy?
So, yes.
Many have. Yes, indeed. Absolutely.
They chose that. I need examples.
Including American slaves. American slaves.
So here's the big thing that Americans never understand. They see the choice as being between a dictator and democracy. They think those are the two options. Mm-hmm. Most of the world has seen the choice as being between anarchy and stability. And stability comes with a strong man and a dictator.
I guess the Russians would probably disagree with me, right?
I mean, all we know is for sure that more than 99% of the Earth's population has not demonstrated a preference for democracy.
That's interesting that you just said that. I mean, people don't look at it the way I'm framing it. They look at it as,
amazing.
This is the whole problem.
This is
outrageous.
Amazing.
This is the whole problem.
But this is a very interesting. I never heard of this
so
way.
So Hobbes,
they look at it as order. So nature is brutish and short and all that.
That's
and
right.
The Hobbesian reality of nature.
Well, and Hobbes lived through the war of all against all. He lived through anarchy. And if you've lived through anarchy, then you're like, fuck, let's get a strong man who brings stability. And, you know, there's that great Arab saying, which is, it's better to live 1,000 years in tyranny than one day in anarchy.
So you're describing the recorded evidence of people's thoughts on democracy. Okay, here's the main thing we know about people on this planet is nothing. We know nothing at all about the vast majority of people who have ever lived.
What do you mean?
There's no evidence. There's just nothing. We have nothing. Even Americans now, we know very little, believe it or not, about most Americans, their lives, but certainly 100, 200, 500, 1,000 years ago, we know nothing about most of the people.
But I think that you are benefiting from...
Except that they existed.
But you're benefiting, and many people are benefiting right now from the efforts of people who came before us who actually did believe in fixed truths.
How am I benefiting?
Well, I would say that the founding fathers, and not all of them were religious and certainly had their own interpretation of what religion was, but they had to come up with sort of, first of all, the idea that we're all of the same moral worth.
Hold on, did the founding fathers believe in fixed truths?
Well,
yes.
Let's
oh, yes.
Well, I think that they were certainly...
It's natural law.
Yeah.
All men are created equal. This absolutely.
That's a fixed truth, at least theoretically. You can't... How do you come up with a doctrine, a Bill of Rights, without saying all men are created equal in the eyes of God?
But they also didn't believe in the fixed truth. I mean, remember that America is being called the American experiment.
Yeah.
And, you know, they certainly didn't believe in the fixed truth that men need a king. Which had always, that was a lot of the historical example, and they certainly believed that you could create a country at this scale.
Would you guys grant at least that there are closer approximations to the...
No.
He didn't let me say it. Really?
No.
Really?
No.
Human sacrifice.
No. So
human sacrifice.
Well,
I mean, come on.
Let me,
the Aztecs.
Let me revise that, what I just said. Here's what I want to say to that. It's not no. My answer to that is actually, I don't know.
Okay, that's fair, but Thaddeus, slavery, you have to make a choice. You're governing a country.
Yep.
You are in the position to actually make law, which is what historically some people have. Thaddeus, our society, do we allow slavery or do we not? And if we do allow slavery, who are the ones enslaved? The weaker, the darker? The fairer sex, how do
people who disagree with me would be enslaved.
Yeah, there you
people
go.
Who believe in truth.
There you go.
Uh-oh, Sam.
But do you know what I'm saying? Because Thaddeus, if then you're going to structure a society and
Sam
you,
is
you
Thaddeus's
have to have certain objective, you have to have objective law. I mean, in a way, that an extent, you've got to have the conversation.
But that's a choice.
It can be.
You can choose to have slavery or choose to not have slavery. And then what are the functional outcomes of those choices? I would choose not to have slavery. Right? In a modern context.
Because you prefer not to be
enslaved
or to enslave others.
That's right. But it's a choice.
It's not that
it's about objective moral truth. It's a choice. Like Thaddeus is saying, he likes the Constitution. But he likes the Constitution because it's personally good for him.
So what do you believe in?
Including the 13th Amendment, which abolishes slavery. I like that one because I don't want to be enslaved and I don't want to enslave others and I don't want to live among...
So you believe you only are willing to speak for yourself
and
what you believe
yes.
in.
And also the point of democracy is that you only speak for yourself, where everybody gets a say, and then you have to work towards consensus.
I know, that's very nice, guys, but the problem is you do have to have laws.
Yes,
but it's a social contract. Okay. And a social contract is one that we all work on, we all revise, and then at the end of the day, we all get to sign on to it.
To work on and revise something, you've got to start with...
an agreement. That's all. A contract. Agreement. A contract.
But that contract comes from the hard work that our philosophers have done before us. Well, I mean, you had, I think the country was founded on let's just call it several truths, but they were rooted in not only faith that we are all created equal in the eyes of God, but also reason.
But
reason being measurable outcomes, measurable things. These are you cannot have an agreement until you have something to agree on, right? I mean,
when you sign a contract to be on a show or whatever,
yeah.
Do you make universal moral claims about that contract,
no.
The terms of it, ever? Is that ever part of the conversation?
No.
You say, this is what all contracts should be. This is all the people in the world should have a contract that looks like this one. No, you just, the studio wants this, you want this, you come to agreement, you sign on the bottom. It's an agreement. And does that work? Does that system work?
Usually.
It's great.
Yeah.
Works really great.
And
so,
and how would you say...
You don't need to make any claims at all.
And
to
how,
live in that
you don't have to make any claims.
And that's a whole system, right? The contracts in, you know, the studios and Hollywood and all that, that's a whole system. The contract is the basis of a system. There are no universal claims in there, as far as I know, that hold it up. It just operates on its own by mutual agreement. Mm. Mutual agreement is all you need.
And also to build
it's
off
a society.
Of what to build off
Hollywood
what
a, is a society.
It's a society,
right?
Yeah.
And to build off of what Thaddeus is saying, how would you say that the 350 million or whatever Americans who are, you know, sort of were signed in at birth to this social contract are feeling about this social contract right now? Does everybody feel like this is a great social contract and we're like totally on board with the other signatories?
We're constantly fighting about it.
Yeah.
I mean, every piece,
we never have stopped fighting, have we?
Every
I mean,
piece of the Bill of Rights, even, which
yeah.
is definitely the best, from my point of view, best part of the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
We fight about every single one of those things. Even slavery. Now, apparently, some people want to bring back slavery, we hear. But the First Amendment is in the news in the last few weeks. Have you
yeah.
seen this? I mean, like, I'm talking about, again, professors, academics, intellectuals, my favorite people. These are the ones. They're writing op-eds in the Washington Post and the New York Times saying, hey, you know what? This First Amendment served its purposes back in the day, but we should think about this again because words hurt people.
Yeah, I fucking... that's the biggest...
So even that's being debated.
That's amazing to me.
But
even
see,
that's
well,
being debated.
Yeah.
The contract needs to be re-clarified and renegotiated. And it's not to say that when you clarify and renegotiate it, that a lot of what the Founding Fathers already figured out won't be there. But you have to get people to understand why the contract is there, why these clauses are there to buy into them, and then you might find that you have to change certain things. And
well,
that certain things
need
to be
a living document, right?
Well, and that's
yeah,
the point, is
that
if you believe it's a living document, then you have to believe that you are A, smart enough to understand what they did, and then to be able to figure out what is baby and what is bathwater in that document.
Well, that's where amendments come in.
Exactly. So yeah. So what you have to do is that as a living document, it should be constantly re-examined.
Well, look at the Supreme Court. That's what you have the Supreme Court for. That's where you have debates about Roe v. Wade. That's where you have these debates about...
Yeah, sure. But what is the citizenry doing? Does the citizenry understand the document? Does the citizenry understand human nature well enough?
First of all, Americans don't know anything.
That's exactly
Americans
the point.
Americans are, as a group, deeply ignorant people. This is the kind of rock I keep
sound like a professor
running up against all the time. Well, yeah, but you know what? I'd rather just leave them alone and let them do their thing. I don't want them to be running foreign policy. I don't really want anyone running foreign policy. By the way, speaking of democracy, like I am now pretty firmly against it.
What are you for?
Leaving people alone. But so let's think about foreign policy. What if we gave Americans real democratic control of foreign policy, right? It's very undemocratic now, right? The president runs most of foreign policy all by himself. Even Congress has very little to do with it. What if we made that truly democratic? The American people really had a say directly in what our foreign policy is, where we deploy troops, where we have bases, where we go to war, when we don't go to war.
Well, first of all, American people don't have the time to even think about
Americans
it. Americans
don't.
They would be visceral about it.
Do you know, have you seen polls of Americans' knowledge of geography?
It's crazy. Yes, I have. And it's
huge percentages.
It's crazy.
Don't know, can't identify on a map where Washington, D.C. is.
That's right.
Okay, so if you're going to ask them where Syria is, good luck.
Yeah.
So what if we came along and we said...
No, I asked a girl last night at the Improv who the vice president of the United States was. I'm not good with politics.
Oh, yeah.
But
yeah.
you you know, I, you could also argue that the founding fathers created a society where we're, it's a society where political commitment isn't as important. Maybe that was the whole point.
No, but tell that girl who you talk to that there's a man in this country in Africa who's enslaving boys, children, to make them fight in his war. He's giving them guns and they're 10 years old and he's making them fight in his war and they are killing and dying and they're killing other children. And I'm going to show you a video of it. And there's these poor children with these guns who are forced, they're enslaved into this army by this terrible man who tortures them. And we're going to call that film Kony 2012.
Yeah.
And she and millions of other people are going to be like, oh my God, we must do something about this now.
Yep.
Do we have a military? Oh yeah. Can we use the military to go fix that
go
problem?
Kill that bad guy.
That's exactly what was happening until dude started running down the street naked on PCP.
Yeah, I know. What happened?
Thank God that happened, because the whole thing was discredited like the next day. I was like, oh, so this is how deep our commitment runs to these, you know.
Yeah, by the way, that Kony movement stopped immediately as soon as he was found
gone.
To be running around
it's
naked.
Like, so, oh, we didn't actually care about those kids. I see. Okay.
Yeah.
But my point is that if you had given Americans power to run foreign policy then, we would be in a huge war in Africa right now. We'd be, you know what we'd
be
doing?
In the Congo.
We would be killing a bunch of black kids in Africa. We'd be killing those very kids we were trying to save. So nightmare. So no, I don't want that. Also, I don't, do you want that girl to choose like where you get to live and where your children have to go to school and
I believe that democracy works, and it's so counterintuitive. I do think there is a wisdom to crowds, and I think Americans are as dumb as you think they are. I maybe because I travel so much and I'm around Americans.
They're not dumb about their own lives.
No.
I'm not saying that.
Yeah,
I'm saying they don't know anything, very little, outside their own lives, which is fine, and I'm not moralizing. That's perfectly fine. In fact, I prefer that. But democracy is the majority dictating what you do, how you live, what you can and cannot do. That's what it is.
Sort of,
if
but we
you
also
are
have the
not
Bill of Rights,
in the majority, that it doesn't matter. You have to do what they tell you.
It's always been, that's always been the tenuous thing. I mean, where the tyranny of the mob and, you know, and
yeah, but it's the tyranny of the mob or the wisdom of crowds. And the key thing is that what's the difference between the tyranny of mob and the wisdom of crowds? I think it relies on mutual respect. I think it relies on dialogue. I think it relies on understanding that there is no truth. There are only different sides to the story.
And I think you're, I think maybe you're speaking practically about how the world really works in the courts. I think if we went and saw how courts actually worked, I think we'd probably, it's like anything else, it's a lot messier than what you think, right?
No, it is messy. Yeah. And that's, but the problem is not that the world is messy. The problem is the type of people who try and pretend that it's clean and that it's simple, because they sell simplicity and they sell the idea of objectivity. And the appeal of objectivity is the feeling of certainty, that you know it, it's okay, you've got it all figured out, it's all going to be okay. And that's what fundamentalism is. Mm-hmm. It's that rigid certainty and that self-satisfaction that we know the truth, Islam is the answer, I don't have to engage in all these messy complexities, I see the world as it truly is, you're either with me or you're against me, and if
well,
you're against
you're talking
me,
about
you're
ideology.
Against truth. Well, I'm talking about psychology. It's not about ideology. You can have that with any ideology. The Soviets had it. You know, the anarcho-capitalists have it. The new atheists have it. You know, ISIS has it. It's a psychology that exists in many, many, many ideologies. But it's the a lot of academics have it.
So what's the escape?
It's embracing uncertainty.
Right. So number one, I would say, is just judge things according to value instead of making absolute claims, truth claims for other people. That's number one. And just doing that, if we just did that, we'd be so much better.
Like Jordan
off.
Peterson says, clean your own room first. Do you have a problem with Peterson? Because I love him.
I like that part of what he says.
What is your take on his idea of postmodernism?
So people are...
On the idea
on Twitter, every day I get about 100 people telling me I need to debate him. And I've actually invited him onto my show and I haven't heard back, which I'm not claiming he's dodging me. It's just, I know he's busy. But anyway, his reading of postmodernism is the exact opposite of the reading of almost everyone I know.
Really?
Yeah.
Explain that.
It's
because I'm only taking the first time I really heard the term postmodernism as and Camille Paglia talks a little bit about this. So I've listened to her.
Okay. So
maybe unpack what he says.
So we have Christianity, as Hunter laid out, right? Absolute truth claims. We all know this. It's men and women, and they do this, and we should do that. It all comes from God, and it's absolute, and there's no debating it. And then the Enlightenment comes along 1,500 years later and says, well, there are absolute truths for sure. It's just that we have a new God the god of science. We're going to replace that god with this new thing called science, and there's a way to achieve what God wants us, which is called the scientific method. Through microscopes, we're going to find out what's true and good. But it's absolute. There's an absolute thing out there. And we're going to organize society around it. So for about two or 300 years, you know, as I said, they said, oh, let's look at human beings and figure out what makes them tick. Well, we have determined through observing them, through registering numbers of how, what they did and who they were, through the size of their skulls and all that stuff, that, you know, there are 27 races and the ones at the bottom should be slaves and the ones at the top should be governors and blah, blah, blah. Okay. And then they did the same thing with women, and they said, look at their fucking bodies. I mean, this nature is telling us it is absolutely true that they should be wives and mothers, and it's actually bad for them to work outside the home. Okay. They just kept going with all these things, and then those get revised in the 20th century, but, you know. And then in the 1960s and 70s, some French intellectuals, and the most prominent ones are Michel Foucault and Jacques Derrida. I'm a huge Foucault fan, but I like Derrida too. And they said, hold up, guys, look, first of all, let's just do something here. So science claims, and they weren't challenging this, they were just saying, so according to science, human beings, sort of as we know it, you know, are about 200,000 years old. Like this thing, this body, this particular organism is 200,000 years old, roughly. And what you modernists are saying at the time, and scientists are saying, is that in this little speck of a moment here, this 0.00025% of human history, that we have now discovered what is truth. We now know what's true. Everybody in the past for the last 200,000 years was wrong, full of shit, racist, terrible, bad, but we know
it's kind of like when you think about Greek philosophy before Socrates, it's like, but there was a huge intellectual tradition before
all before
Plato.
Us is wrong, yeah. And we have it right. And here's the thing, we know. We're absolutely sure, okay? Yeah. So that is settled. All these things, many, many things are settled now, okay? So all they did actually was look at history, and that's really all you've got to do, and that's one of the things I love about being a historian. It's like anytime someone makes a truth claim, I'm just like, okay, so 10 years ago, you do know this, right? There was a different truth claim about that very thing, right? Scientists have changed their minds about what is true every day. Every single day since there's been science. There's, as I said, gravity. They're changing that now. Everything, how light works, you name it. How is this hard? Is this soft? Is this, you know, is this a table? Every question of morality, that changes constantly.
And their trap is that they're looking for one single truth,
But every time there's this consensus in a society where they're, no, we got it. This is right. This is correct. And this is true for everybody. And it always will be. And then they're like 10 years later, no, actually, sorry, slavery is bad. We forgot. Or something. They just change it. So truth changes constantly. So that's what the postmodernists did. And they didn't say that there is no such thing as reality. They just said what I said earlier, which is we don't know. So it's not atheism, right? It's not saying there is absolutely no God. There is absolutely
they're
truth.
Agnostics.
Exactly. That's my new word. That's the one I'm using a lot now. I think it's really useful.
I just don't know what
don't
to do
know.
With I don't know. I like I don't know. And I think you need a lot. We all need a lot more I don't know in our
lives.
Well,
you know what you like and what you want right now, don't you?
Yes.
Then go for it. That's okay. It. So make your next decision based on that.
That would be my truth. So Peterson says, you know, being intellectually honest in terms of reporting what you see, at least, is something that's probably rarer than
you think. No. So if you say, I see this in that painting, that's one claim, but I don't think he's saying that. I think he's saying there is only one way, or there is a true way to see this painting, doesn't he? I think that's what he's saying.
Well, I think, so at least Peterson's critique of postmodernism is the idea that everything is a power relationship, and there are people that oppress, and there are people that are oppressed, and there are really two teams in that sense. So, and I'm paraphrasing, and I'm not being fair to him because he's a smart guy with a much deeper
idea. But this, can we also put a button on that? I want to come back to that.
So that's absolutely the opposite.
Whoa. Hold on. Sorry, everybody.
So that is absolutely the opposite of my reading of Foucault and Derrida. It's the opposite. So in fact, and I can show you chapter and verse, and here's the problem. Almost no one has read these guys, and I don't. That's fine. I get it. And they're hard to read, and you know, not everyone studied humanities in colleges. Foucault's whole argument about power, in fact, is that it operates among everyone, among all classes, between groups, among groups, from bottom to top, and from top to down, and from top to bottom. That power is discursive. It operates through language. So right now in this conversation, there's the power dynamic among the three of us. And it's not just from here to you to you. It goes mm-hmm. back and forth and up and down and around us. And you create some and then I receive it and then give it back to you, something different, right? It's not two classes. It's not the oppressed and the oppressor. In fact, that's exactly what Foucault tried to overthrow, which was this Marxist idea that there are oppressors, the capitalist, and the oppressed, the working class. Everyone listening should Google, if you don't believe me, Google the words postmodernism and Marxism, and you will see that the people who hate postmodernism more than Jordan Peterson are Marxists.
Really?
They hate the fucking guts of those French horseshit-slinging assholes, which is exactly, that's a quote from a Marxist historian who talked to me about it for the first time in the 1990s when I was in graduate school. He said, so are you studying that postmodernist horseshit up at Columbia? I was like, why are you so mad about it? He said, well, because it like there's no truth anymore. And there's no way to organize our politics and there's no way to organize society. And how are we supposed to have any kind of meaningful politics if there's no truth? And I was like, well, I hadn't read it yet. So I was like, I don't know. Wow, that sounds pretty bad.
Well, how does Jared Derrida propose we organize?
He doesn't. That's what
you can't have anarchy. You sound like Michael Malice.
It's not anarchy. Michael's a good friend of mine.
Yeah. I love Michael, but you guys,
we're not.
I can't.
No. It's not anarchy. Well, anarchy, I'm not a nihilist. I'm not saying there should be no order. I'm not saying there should be no rules, in fact. Yeah. Here's what I want to do. I want to have a mutual agreement between you and Hunter and me and our neighbors that we will, in this neighborhood or this, you know, society where we live, we will not allow rape. We will not allow murder. We will not allow the killing of children for fun.
The Constitution.
Yeah.
The Bill of Rights.
A set of rules, right?
So you like the Constitution and the Bill of Rights.
But I'm going to say it's only because I want to live that way and you want to live that way and we can live that way forever without ever making a claim for anyone else in the world.
And also, Brian, there's a huge, huge difference between thinking of the Constitution as this contract that we've all bought into and we've all agreed in, and then the sort of mythic cultural cult status of it, where we have now turned it from something that we all bought into to the truth, right? Those two are totally different.
Exactly.
And the problem is that...
Explain why that's dangerous, to assume that it's the truth.
Once it becomes the truth, right?
You want it to apply to everybody.
And you start to want to apply it. You start to want to apply it to everyone.
And you start the conversation. It's anti-intellectual. Right? It's anti-science.
It's no longer a living document, mm-hmm. right? And crucially, the scientific mind is an experimental one.
It's authoritarian.
It's authoritarian.
You're saying, stop talking about this.
And you have to listen to me.
Like climate change. Hey, you know it's a settled science. What's the word? That's the word they use. It's settled. It's a settled science. I'm like, oh, really? Well, what exactly is settled? What? How much? It's settled that we know how much the earth is going to, what the temperature of the earth will be tomorrow and in 10 days and in 100. Really? That's settled? You guys all agree on that? We don't have to study this anymore? What they're actually saying is we shouldn't study climate change anymore.
That's very, very good, because once you establish that this is the truth, there's nothing more to talk about.
That's why people say you can't say certain things on stage. Mm-hmm. Because we know it's a truth that your words about certain things do violence to us.
Well, first of all, equality is the God.
Violence, right?
Equality is the great God that we all pray to.
What you say about white people or black people or whatever it is does violence to people. It does violence to us. And we know this. Why? Because we know what it is to be those people.
Truth orthodoxy.
I love Orny Adams, who's about to do his 1 hour special for Showtime. And last night I was watching him, very funny. And Orny said, I'm giving one of his jokes away, but it's worth it because you should definitely listen to Orny Adams. This is my this is an advertisement for Orny. And he says, everything's got to be equal, including sex. I guess we should just have sex on our sides with both of each other. Oh, you're equal, girl. You're so equal. You like this equality? You know what I mean? He was right. It's
But Brian, hey, look, man, look. Thomas Jefferson said all men are created equal. They were egalitarian, so that's right. This is the thing, though. He said it is rooted in nature. That's what the Declaration of Independence says.
Yeah.
All men are created equal by our creator.
Yeah.
So there's no... That's settled.
Yeah.
That we should all be treated equally.
Well, the genius of the Constitution, though, was that you could interpret it. You could say life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. How general those are. Those are general concepts.
You can interpret the Constitution, the founders said. They did not say you can interpret equality and whether it's good or bad.
But see, Brian, when you say the genius of the Constitution and all of that, are you saying that because of what Brian thinks or the received wisdom of Brian's culture?
Uh, the received wisdom of Bryan's culture, but also the fact that I would argue that the Constitution, as it stands, so all men are entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, for example, that gives human beings great leeway over their own lives and great leeway over sort of their own, the choices they make. That's probably the strength of the United States, is the idea that, look, that guy may think differently, act differently, talk differently, but you leave him alone. Well, but leave him alone, because if you don't leave him alone, then you're going to pay a price, because he might be way more creative, et cetera, than you think. But don't make a judgment on what that person over there is worth, because you don't know for sure.
But even those are laden with value judgments, or you proceed with values, right? So what is leeway? Freedom. What is freedom? Well, a lot of people happen to think they are more free as slaves. That's been said. A lot of people say they are more free as faithful members of the Catholic Church, and they do what the Pope tells them to do.
Yeah.
This is a common argument. This is not even a minority,
no,
right? We are more so.
Well, with freedom comes great responsibility.
So
you got to make a lot of choices on your own.
So you define freedom in a particular way,
yeah,
and that's cool. Do it. But I'm just saying that's not truth.
However, no, I think that the genius of the Founding Fathers was that you have the choice. You have the right and the choice to join the Catholic Church, to join the YMCA, to join whatever the Nazi order, mm-hmm, the new Nazi order in Oregon, wherever it is. Or the Libertarian Party. Either way, you have a right to life. I can't take your life. Liberty.
These are fiction.
Whatever that means.
These are cool stories they told. Really, and I mean that.
But they work.
They're fictions. I know, but they are. They're just stories. They're fictions. They're made up. Thomas Jefferson did not have a conversation with God on July 3rd, 1776. He made that shit up. He wrote it down.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. You agree with this? Okay. Yes. He didn't look in blades of grass to see that where truth was in nature. He fucking made it up.
Yeah.
Now, he made it up.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. I happen to like a lot of that. Not all of it, but I happen to like a lot of the stuff that came out of his brain, his mind. You don't have to say it's universal. You can just say, I prefer this. I'm glad we live according to this constitution as opposed to the Afghan constitution.
Yeah.
Okay.
And if you do that, then you might recognize that the current realities in the United States are not the same as the current realities in Libya or Russia or Afghanistan or Iraq. And that maybe you shouldn't practice what academics call isomorphic mimicry, where you try and take your institutions and keep slapping them on top of underlying cultures that aren't ready to support those things. So what the United States does when it engages in its dictator removal program is it creates power vacuums. And when you create power vacuums, those power vacuums don't stay that way. Nature abhors a vacuum, and in rush all these other things like ISIS.
Mm-hmm.
It's really irresponsible to keep removing these strongmen. You can push for more inclusive and responsive courts. You can support all of that, but removing the dictators is not a responsible action, and it comes out of Americans' ignorance of geopolitics, the hard work that actually went into writing the Constitution, the evolution of English common law, the Glorious Revolution. Americans don't know their own history. They've internalized this myth that, like, oh, we had a dictator, King George III, who was the devil, and then we got rid of our Saddam Hussein, and then, bam, democracy just happened.
Problem is, sometimes it works, right? So it worked in Korea, at least
for half the country.
It worked in
Greece.
No, it didn't.
Look what it created.
Well, it created.
We sealed off those poor people with that fucking maniac family
and
ruling over them. We surrounded them with our army and the South Korean army and the Chinese army.
And what happened in South Korea? What do you know about the history of South Korea after the Korean War?
Well, I think I'd rather be living in South Korea than I would.
That's correct.
North
Korea. But do you know about the transitional process that happened? What was the transitional process?
From what's her name's book.
Yeah, and what was the transitional process?
The transitional process was essentially kind of galvanizing as a group.
They had a benevolent dictator, and that benevolent dictator created reform. He was a lot like, what's his name, Lee Kuan Yew in Singapore.
Yeah.
So the point is the same thing as Napoleon, the same thing as a lot of rulers, where you have these transitional figures who transition the society from monopoly on legitimate violence, which is,
well,
you know, anarchy.
That's the credit they give to Stalin sometimes, even though he killed 40 million people.
And then you transition to rule of law. Russia doesn't have rule of law. It still doesn't. It has a 99% conviction rate in the courts. So it's the transition from tyranny to rule of law is really, really hard. It's really, really hard. And most people don't understand that. And actually building those sorts of institutions and responsive courts is really difficult. And it isn't made easier by removing dictators, by removing the source of stability. And the problem is the United States is the world's greatest gated community. And people like Tom Woods, my friend Piggy, grow up inside the world's greatest gated community, and they look at the walls, and they look at the guards, and they say, this is so terrible. Why do I have to have these walls and guards?
Oh, wait, so you're advocating for the walls and guards?
Yes.
Why? To keep the bad people out?
No, because I think that there's what you want to do is you want to this all comes down to the Dunbar number. So every animal, right? We talk about human nature. The founding fathers talked about human nature.
Another cool story.
Which is
total fiction.
It's a terrible fiction.
Set of fictions, yeah.
It's a terrible fiction. In 1776, the data that was available on human biology was virtually non-existent. They talked about the state of man. They'd never met a hunter-gatherer. They'd never met any of these people.
They've never met most people who live.
They've never met most people who live.
We know the fucking arrogance, seriously, of my people, intellectuals, right? This is what they do. We do.
I don't know if the founding fathers were the intellectuals that we are talking about today.
In terms of their, they
had tremendous respect for the common man insofar as you give the common man choice over his own life.
Right.
That's what the Bill of Rights and the Amendment was, but you have to give them credit. You have to give them credit for at least creating the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. And the amendments, because that is in fact the balance of powers.
Okay,
the balance
so
of powers
actually
like, address the idea of who governs the governor.
Actually,
people for the people, government for the people, by the people, of the people. That's a radical idea.
I actually agree with you more than disagree with you. So the way they enacted this new form of government, of course, shat on the common man, right?
Yeah.
Slavery and not giving the vote to poor people, etc. The ideas, though, certainly in the Declaration of Independence and most of Jefferson's writing when he wasn't being a scientific racist, is absolutely egalitarian and does sort of, in a way, create the common man, this idea that there is such a thing as the common man, and it grants the common man equality,
yeah.
Equality under the law. So, yeah, but I'm saying here, actually, that has killed and enslaved and imprisoned more people than any other idea in history.
Sir, communism has us beat. So does fascism.
Exactly. What did communism say about equality?
Well, yeah, they were.
What was their entire justification for putting people in concentration camps?
Well, there's a fundamental difference, right? Which is that we will socially engineer.
The idea is the same. All men are created equal, and if they're not treated equally, we must make them.
I think there's a fundamental difference. There is equality of opportunity versus equality of outcome.
I think communism was about equality of outcome.
These are the shibboleths
of your culture, Brian, and it's great that you have internalized the received wisdom of your people like a good Muslim boy that you are. But I think the thing that you have to bear.
But Hunter, you are not giving credit where it's due. You must give credit to the founding fathers.
What do you mean? Like I'm supposed
for
to...
coming up with a better system, at least on Earth, than the other system.
And Muhammad,
Thomas Jefferson. I mean,
and Muhammad
what does this mean, though? Should we give thanks? Should we have statues? Should we have everyone? Your house. Why isn't there a statue of Thomas Jefferson in your house?
Give credit.
Should I fillet a statue of Thomas Jefferson when
yes.
I get up in the morning for the Bill of Rights?
Yes. Like, what I'm saying is that give credit where it's due. We benefit every day, guys, from the scientific method and from a group of people that in many ways solve the political problem. Greece couldn't do.
Thank you, guys. Thanks back then. Thanks.
Thank you.
But what do you want?
You guys are saying, well, to believe in the Constitution or sort of like what the founding fathers were after is you're putting it in many ways on the same footing as some of the other ideas. And I think
I'm putting
the foundational idea. Yes. I'm saying that the foundational idea is the same. The enactment of it, of course, is clearly very different in the United States from in the Soviet Union.
But to Thaddeus's point, think about the effect of U.S. foreign policy since World War II.
It's been great. It's gone really well for a lot of people, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Last time I checked,
that was a rebuttal to Soviet power.
But if you want to talk about philosopher kings who think they see the world so clearly, talk about American foreign policy since World War II. What has it done? Has it generally improved the quality of people's lives, or has it led to the deaths of a lot of people?
I'm not ready to answer that, but that's a long conversation.
Well, I would read.
I would suggest that the world is probably better off because the U.S. maybe had the edge over.
Guess what I'm writing? Guess what I'm writing my current book about?
Well, I know because I listened to your podcast with Dave Smith,
The History of American Foreign Policy.
Oh, really?
That's what I'm doing. I'm doing a whole. It's kind of the renegade. Several renegade.
Well, everybody should read your book because it's such a fresh.
Thanks, man.
It's such a fresh outlook, and I think what you have to say, and you know, I feel like I'm talking to Hunter because you guys seem to be very much on the same side, and it's a very interesting and fascinating.
We didn't even get to your people.
Outlook.
Aren't you Irish?
I'm Irish and Italian.
Oh, shit. Yeah. Monkeys and Negroes.
That's right.
Yeah, there you go.
That, can you just very quickly give us that before you leave? I know you got to
go. You are descended from, we're not sure. It's either, we're still deciding. It's either monkeys or Negroes. We haven't quite come down on one side.
What does that mean?
Half of us, half of our scientists believe that Italians and the Irish are Negro, and the other half think you're chimps. So we just
don't
know.
That's not offensive at all. So,
well, what I just described to you is science in the 19th century, circa the 19th century. That's right. What that was the consensus on,
yes,
those two groups,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So, and that's
and
why.
I've read this before.
Yeah. 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 So that's why the Irish, you know, were denied jobs, et cetera.
And because we were probably the
one or the other, either
or
black or monkeys. I don't know.
Yeah.
And the same with the Italians a little bit later,
which forced them into certain.
Which is really, by the way, which is also really great for not only forcing them into certain kinds of jobs, but excluding them from the good ones.
Yeah.
And by the way, it wasn't completely untrue. So the Irish and Italians and the Jews during that time were a bunch of fucking criminals for the most part. I mean, they really were, and they worked like shit, and they were drunks, and
because they were
from
the
peasant societies where these ideas about the work ethic and the nuclear family and
you hear this stuff about Syrian immigrants, etc.
Yeah.
Well, they've been. They haven't had any school, and they had very different values.
And if we didn't allow those people into this country, we wouldn't have American popular culture. We wouldn't have stand-up comedy. We wouldn't have dancing. We wouldn't have hip-hop.
All the things that gives us color.
The stuff that I like, a lot of the stuff that I like. So, and what happened, though, is that they said, oh, shit, what we have to do is to get fully into this country to get the vote and all these things is we have to assimilate. And so the Irish were like, ah, fuck the blacks. We're going to be racist now. We're going to lead the draft riots during a civil war. And we're going to be like known for our racism and we're going to stop dancing. I mean, literally the Irish Catholic Church in Boston put out like dictums saying we do not dance anymore. And the Irish were famous for their dancing. They invented tap dancing.
Incredible. Yeah.
And so they stopped dancing and they worked hard on the drinking. They weren't super successful at that, but there was a lot of moralizing about drinking, which didn't happen before. And most importantly, stop fucking drinking on the job, you fucking stupid mix. Because that's what they would do. They would like, they were hired to build the canals or dig the canals that connected the Great Lakes to the Atlantic. Worst work in the world, right? They would just drink whiskey all day long. And like,
it's like the Russians in the coal mines.
Yeah, exactly. And the priests would come down and say, hey, stop this. Yep. You've got to shape up. Work hard, believe that work is good, all that stuff. Yeah. So they assimilated.
Don't dance, don't fuck.
And that's why that's why Irish now, you know, are like totally American and we never even think twice about
them.
Well,
in Leon Uris,
good Americans.
Leon Uris's book, Trinity,
the
family is ruined. The family's ruined because the priest, she admits to the priest that she has sex because she enjoys it. And that's considered a huge, and if you read A Portrait of an Artist, it's a young man, same thing. Thaddeus Russell, we're going to end on that note, and I think at the end of this, I realize that I'm right and you guys are wrong.
Totally. That's clear.
And which is that's great. That's the great thing about truth is that it allows you to feel that you're right and you're wrong, and then next, you're morally justified in going out and fucking people over.
There you go.
You get to impose your reality, naive realism on other people.
Good job, man.
You've learned the lesson.
I'm in a box today. I'm going over to Gloveworks with Wayne McCulloch. So you and I are both a couple of tough guys with big brains. not me. I just appreciate talking to guys like you and Hunter. Thanks for doing the podcast, man.
Thanks
Let's do this
me.
Again
because
there's
fun.
So much more to talk about.
Anytime.
Read A Renegade History of the United States. People ask me what to read all the time.
And listen to Unregistered.
A fucking great book, man.
And listen to Unregistered, Thaddeus' podcast.
I'm going to start listening to that.
Unregistered
for sure.
Podcast, yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
You radical son of a bitch.
And I think
you non-truth believing bastard.
Well, what I finally realized is that I think that between Thaddeus and me, and I think Chris Ryan would be another great ally in this, we may have a chance of finally detribalizing Brian Callen.
Oh, boy.
Is he still Irish?
What, Brian?
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you.